Okay, good morning, good Bach. Welcome back to our bi-monthly shiur here at Shari Tzedek. It's a pleasure to be back. I know it was more than one week, and then more than 2 weeks, I think, also, since last time we had to push it off a week. I'm sorry about that. It's partially my fault, although it's mostly your guys' fault. But I'm happy to be back together learning here in the shul on this Sunday morning, Rosh Chodesh Sivan. The month of learning in our kollel has a sponsor by Rosenberg and Steinmetz PC, and we appreciate their sponsorship. And today's shiur in particular is sponsored by Ron and Sarah Solomon in honor of Ron's birthday. 21st birthday, I heard. Very nice. Mazel tov, and celebrate many more birthdays. And the kollel should celebrate many more sponsorships. Okay, yeah, we all agree with that. Okay, so I wanted to talk today about a Shavuos topic, being that we're holding in the week of the Chag of Shavuos coming up. Mirz Hashem, what, Thursday night is Shavuos already, right? Thursday night. So it makes sense to talk about something apropos of the upcoming Yontif. Last time we spoke about Sfiras HaOmer. We spoke about making the bracha after a person had already missed a day of Sfiras HaOmer. Are there any kunsin? Are there any tricks, any ways that a person can make the bracha? We spoke about those interesting ideas from the Beis HaLevi, etc. This time, sort of, there's not all that much written, at least by Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank and his Tshuvas, about the Yontif of Shavuos. So I figured we'd be a little creative. We'd talk about something that seems unrelated to Shavuos, but we'll try to apply it to the Yontif, which is the topic that we have on our sheets over here, the Tshuva in Har Tzvi by Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. In Or HaChaim Chelek Aleph, that's the first volume, Siman Ayin Gimel. Now here the question that's being posed has nothing to do with Shavuos, but as you'll probably figure out on your own pretty quickly, it has everything to do with Shavuos, because we know there's a minug on Shavuos. What do we do at night?
Stay up all night
doing what?
Learning.
No.
Eating.
Mostly eating. And that eating takes place oftentimes in or around the vicinity of the shul. And the question becomes, is that a permissible practice? Is a person allowed to partake of a meal or even a snack inside of a shul? Or is there something special about the area that a person is not allowed to do so? Now again, the Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank is not dealing with that question. But through the question that he is dealing with, we'll hopefully come back, Bli Neder, Mirz Hashem, to discuss that and touch on it at least briefly and discuss that idea of eating in the shul on Shavuos night. So the question that is posed in the very first paragraph, the first line over here on the page that you have in your source sheet in front of you, the question that was asked by another Rav to Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank was, are we allowed to hold a Shalash Shodis in shul? Do you guys have Shalash Shodis here?
Yes.
Where do you do it? In this room.
Right.
So, but in some shuls, there's not so many rooms. There's not so many places to do a meal. And so when they want to host a Shalash Shodis, it doesn't have to be a Shalash Shodis. Sometimes it's an Afraf, a bar mitzvah, a suda that takes place in a shul. So is that a permissible practice? The shul that I grew up in happens to be there are more rooms than this, but oftentimes there's so much going on in the shul that I grew up in. I think there were 10 minyanim on Shabbos morning. So every room is used. So you have a simcha. Sometimes you have three simchas in the shul. So oftentimes one of the rooms that had to be used was one of the places that was the shul. It was the base medrash. It was a shul. And they used to have to hold an afra for bar mitzvah, sheva brachas all the time in that room. Is that permissible? Is that allowed? Or is that problematic? So in order to even appreciate the shaila, we can't ask the question without understanding why we're asking the question. So let's try to appreciate it first, the basis for the inquiry. Why is it that we even have a struggle here? Why are we even wondering if it's permissible to eat shalash shodis or any food for that matter in a shul room? So the psukim both in Parshas Kedoshim and in Parshas Behar tell us es mikdashi tira'u, which means that a person has to have fear, have reverence, have awe for the Beis HaMikdash. It's the Makom HaShechina. It's the place where HaKadosh Baruch Hu resides in a more acute sense, and therefore a person has to experience a sense of yira, of awe, of reverence inside of a Beis HaMikdash. That's absolutely true. We do not have a Beis HaMikdash anymore, so seemingly this mitzvah no longer applies. However, 2 points. First of all, Yiras Shemayim does still apply. We always have to have Yiras Shemayim. Es Mikdashi Tira'u means that there's a more elevated sense, a more intensified sense of Yiras Shemayim because there's more elevated presence and more intensified presence of the Shechina of Hashem. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu exists in every place in the world and in everything in our lives, and therefore we always have to experience a feeling of Yiras Shemayim. So obviously the mitzvah of Yiras Hashem didn't go anywhere. But furthermore, what's so fascinating is that some of the commentaries note that maybe this mitzvah of Es Mikdashi Tiro in particular, the mitzvah to have fear, to have awe, to act with reverence in the Beis HaMikdash applies nowadays, even though we do not have a Beis HaMikdash. How would that be? What's one obvious answer? Good, that's the second obvious answer. Is there another answer also? So there's what to think about here, but also we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, but we do have a Makom HaMikdash. We do have a place where the Mikdash is supposed to be. Now, it happens to be it's got the wrong thing on it right now, and it's not really built up the way we want it to be, but that place has inherent Kedusha as well. So we have to think about that as well, the inherent Kedusha to the land itself of Eretz Yisrael, which draws its Kedusha from the Makom HaMikdash, that's Lo Batela. That Kedusha never goes away, the Rambam tells us, and therefore that level of the mitzvah certainly exists in our reality. But furthermore, as you pointed out a second ago, there's something called a Mikdash Ma'at. The Sforno, in his commentary on the Psukim, he says that this mitzvah of Es Mikdashi Tiro does apply, in fact, nowadays, to our modern shuls, to our shuls that exist in modern contemporary times. It's based on the Pasuk in Yecheskel, which you were quoting, the Gemara in Megillah and Daf Chav Tes, darshens the Pasuk when the Navi says, Mikdash Me'at, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will make for us, based on Mikdash, a miniature in the Galus, in the diaspora. So the Gemara darshens, Elu Bate Knesios Shebe Bavel and Shebe Eretz Yisrael, these are the Bate Knesios that exists in the diaspora, meaning even though we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, we have a Beis HaKnesses, we have a shul, and that shul is looked at as a Mikdash Chem, as a Mikdash, a Beis HaMikdash, Ves Mikdashi Tiro applies there as well. In terms of building a shul, there are actually many nafka minas. We're not going to get into them now. It's not really the topic of our discussion. But if you look in Rav Asher Weiss's Sefer on the Torah, on the Chumash, truth is, they just published a new edition of it. There's a sefer called Minchas Asher by Rav Asher Weiss. Rav Asher Weiss is a contemporary gadol. He lives in Eretz Yisrael. He comes to America. He's English speaking. He's maybe he's been to here. I don't know. Has he been to the shul? He's a very big Talmid Chacham. It's a special. Okay, there you go. He's a special Talmid Chacham. So he wrote Svarim on a Chumash called Minchas Asher. He also wrote Tshuvas, and he's actually really a prolific writer. You can fill a shelf or two with his books in general, but Minchas Asher on the Chumash is basically where he goes through the different parshios and tells you a sugya that comes out of those psukim. So in Parshas Balak, I think it is, he has this sugya of the similarities between the Beis HaMikdash and the Beis HaKnesses. He gives us 12 nafkaminas, 12 cases in halacha where you see that the construction of the Beis HaKnesses has to in some way mimic the construction of the Beis HaMikdash, because it's a form of a Mikdash Ma'at. My Rabbi Rav Shechter Shlita has a sefer called Eretz HaTzvi. In Eretz HaTzvi, Simin Yud Beis, he has those nafkaminas and more. He has multiple practical applications of this idea that you're supposed to build a shul in a way that sort of imitates, mimics the Beis HaMikdash. The Chassam Sofer was asked, as in Aruch Chaim, Simin Chav Ches, the Chassam Sofer was asked in Pressburg in the 1800s, he was asked about the possibility of moving the bima. The bima, classically and traditionally, is in the middle of the shul, and that's where we lane Kriyas HaTorah from. But the shul had asked him that it would help aesthetically, and it would help also functionality of the shul. It would make more room for seats. I think this is true in a lot of places. You have a bima, a heavy, bulky bima in the middle of the shul, so it takes area, seating area away from the shul. So what if we want to move the bima all the way to the front and do everything from there, lane, daven, everything from that bima in the front of the shul? So the Chassam Sofer was asked this question. He said, absolutely not. B'shem panim v'yofim, you can't do that. He says, if you look in the Rambam, in Hilchos Tefillah in Parakeet Aleph, and you look also in the Shulchan Aruch and Simen Kuf Nun, the poskim say, the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam say, that the bima absolutely has to be in the middle of the shul. That's actually a psak halacha. The way the Beis HaKnesses is constructed is a psak halacha. That is based on a Gemara in Sukkah and Dafnan Aleph, which tells us that's how the Beis HaKnesses in Alexandria was constructed. But additionally, the Chassam Sofer says there's another meaning to it as well. He says that the bima, which is in the Beis HaKnesses, is actually representative of the Mizbeach, which exists in the Beis HaMikdash. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash, but the Bima is supposed to be representative of the Mizbeach. And the Mizbeach is supposed to be the center of our attention, the center of the room in the Beis HaKnesses. It's the place from which we offer our karbanos, which we no longer have. But says the Chassam Sofer, a beautiful imagery, when a person goes up there and lanes Parshas HaKarbanos, or I don't know, in some shuls they have this thing before davening. They say karbanos. I don't know what that's about. Some minog, some old minog, they used to say karbanos beforehand. But whatever, when karbanos are said, they're projected from the beam in the middle of the shul. It's as if we're offering the karbanos from the mizbeach, because the mizbeach is representative of, bima is representative of the mizbeach that exists in the Beis HaMikdash. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash, but we do have a Mikdash Ma'at, and says the Chassam Sofer, ve'ein lishanos, we cannot change the Mikdash Ma'at shelanu. We cannot change, we cannot deviate from the way that our Mikdash Ma'at is supposed to be constructed to a different way in contemporary times. In terms of the construction of the Beis HaKnesses, the aesthetic changes in the shul, so that was a hot topic when the Chassam Sofer dealt with it in Pressburg in the 1800s. That was the whole the whole driving force of the reform, was to change, was to switch things around, to make things more aesthetically pleasing, more enjoyable, put a choir into the shul, put organs into the shul, right? Do the whole show of everything, dress more like the priests, right? That was the reform movement. So the Chassam Sofer was the one who was dealing very carefully and very emphatically with these reformers. He was the one who coined the term, I mean, Chazal coined the term, but he utilized the term chadash aser min haTorah. Really, any change is aser. Any change is aser. You can't change things without the halachic basis. And this, he thought, was certainly within the realm of a change which was not halachically sanctioned. Even without makoros, comparison to the Beis HaMikdash, so we have a masorah on the way a shul is supposed to look, on the way a Beis Medrash is supposed to look. There's a sefer called, a book called Meged Givos Olam. It's written by a Talmud Chacham in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Michal Shurkin. Rav Michal Shurkin was a Talmud of Moshe Feinstein. He also sat in the Rav Soloveitchik's shirim in Yeshiva University, but he was a very colorful, dynamic character. Anyone here have any relationship with Toras Moshe, a yeshiva in Israel? Tomo? Okay, he's a Rebbe in Tomo. So, very interesting character. So he has a book called Meged Givos Olam. It's a storybook. He tells a lot of stories about the yeshiva Beis HaTalmud in Brooklyn. So in one of the cases there, he tells a story that Rabbi Aryeh Leib Malin used to say over, that Rabbi Aryeh Malin used to say, Rabbi Aryeh Leib Malin was one of the biggest Talmidim of the Mir. He was a Shanghai, survivor through the, he was an Altamir. He was a Bacher. He didn't get married till much later. But he survived with the Mir through Shanghai, came to America, and he was one of the Rosh Yeshiva in Beis HaTalmud. Beis HaTalmud was supposed to be like the Mikdash Me'at of the Mir in America. It was supposed to be the mimicry of the Mir in America. In Brooklyn, they kept things very carefully, very seriously, like the Mir did in Europe. So Rabbi Aryeh Leib Malin used to say that there's a halach l'moshe mi-Sinai. There's a tradition that we have that's hard to put into words on what a Beis Medrash is supposed to look like. We have, for Moshe Rabbeinu, he meant it figuratively, but we have a halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai, a tradition on Masorah, on how our shuls, on how our Batei Medrash is supposed to look. And there's a story in Beis HaTalmud that one time the Bachur Moy is thirsty during Seder. So I don't know, you had to go to the sink was a little bit warm, so what they did is they all chipped in, they bought a water fountain. And overnight, outside the Beis Medrash, was this room, so right outside of the room, outside the doors, they installed the water fountain right there. And they came in the next morning to see their installation, and they get there, and one of the rabbeim in the yeshiva was with a screwdriver and a hammer undoing the water fountain, taking it out and throwing it into the trash. They said, "My high, Rebbe, we just put that in last night. Why are you doing that?" So he said, "Das is Nishkin Park. This is not a park. It's not a park. A park has a water fountain. A Beis Medrash doesn't have a water fountain." Thankfully, they never stepped into YU. We have a water fountain in the Beis Medrash. On the second floor above, we have a water fountain in the Beis Medrash. Okay, so we might have a different halacha moshe mi-Sinai. It was right outside the Beis Medrash, yeah.
What's wrong with that?
It's a tzura of how the building's supposed to look, he thought. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. We have El HaKadosh Pnima. We have a water fountain inside. But, okay. Either way, whether you agree with the example or not, it's certainly an important idea. There's a Mikdash Ma'at. There's a halachos that dictate that. There's a halachos of what the Beis HaMikdash is supposed to look like that carry over to our shuls. And there's a masorah. There's a feel that you can't necessarily put into the words, but you have to follow our gut, our guidance, in terms of how a shul, how a Beis Medrash is supposed to look. Being that the Beis HaKnesses is a Mikdash Ma'at, so first of all, it impacts the construction, as we said until now, but additionally, it also changes the way we behave inside. A person might behave a certain way on the street, in his house, etc., but when they step into a Beis HaKnesses, when they step into a shul, they're supposed to act differently. The Gemara and Megillah on Daf Chaf Ches delineate some of the hanhagos, some of the behaviors that a person should engage in and should refrain from when in a Beis HaKnesses, when in a Beis HaMedrash, and there we'll get into it soon, but the Gemara lists a few different ideas. Is this Midaraisa or Midarabanan? I mean, the Pasuk says, Es Mikdashi Tiro, that there's a certain connection between Beis HaMikdash and Beis HaKnesses. Is that Daraisa? Is that literally a biblical prohibition? Or is that Midarabanan? I mean, it's similar to a Beis HaMikdash, not Mamish a Beis HaMikdash, and therefore it's not going to be an Isser Daraisa. So that is a Machlokes HaRishonim, very fascinatingly. The smak, the smag, the yireim, the Chafetz Chaim quotes all of these in the beginning of his sefer. I'll tell you why soon in a second. So some of the Rishonim do say it's the Raisa, the Ran, and others assume it's only Midarabanan, which I guess would have been my initial thought. We would have thought it's a nice smachta, it's a good hint from the Pasuk, it's an allusion, but it's not really a biblical prohibition, but some of the Rishonim really do hold that way. In the Mishnah Brura, when he paskins the Shaila, he actually seems to say pretty clearly that it is actually an Isser Daraisa. Mitzvah Daraisa, Es Mikdashi Tiro, to show reverence, to show awe, to show respect in a shul, just like you would show in a Beis HaMikdash. Why did the Chavetz Chaim talk about this? Anyone know? Have we spoken about this in the past? The Chavetz Chaim wrote a sefer called? Chavetz Chaim, yeah, very good, excellent, very good. I really didn't expect you all to know that. He also wrote others for him, correct, but this one he wrote is Chavetz Chaim. Chavetz Chaim is a sefer about Hilchos Lashon Hara, right? Be'al Nechaber, Hilchos Lashon Hara, Shmiras HaLashon. So in the very beginning of the Sefer, he has a Psicha, an opening to the Sefer, Hagdama, right? Introduction to, he actually has a Hagdama and a Psicha. So in the Psicha, in the opening to the Sefer, he lists for us, just so we know the severity of the Isser of Lashon Hara, he lists for us all the possible violations a person can be over when they speak Lashon Hara. And he gets for us, if you tally it all up, and the weather is just right, you can violate 31 Isurim. 17 negative commandments and 14 positive commandments. Now, you'd have to speak Lashon Hara about your older brother, who's a Kohen, and he's also your mother. Like, you have to figure out a way to put it all together that you're going to get all 31. But the point is that in any given scenario, there are 31 things to choose from. You can pick your picks, and you'll get to be violating a lot of different Isurim when you speak Lashon Hara. So in that context, the Chafetz Chaim says, one of the Isurim a person will violate is they'll be mevatel, they'll not fulfill the mitzvah esed, the positive commandment of es mikdashi tira'o. Why? Because sometimes people talk Lashon Hara in their home, and sometimes they talk Lashon Hara in their sukkah. Teshu kein taduru, right? You got to do in your sukkah the way you do in your home. So we talk Lashon Hara house, you got to talk Lashon Hara in the sukkah. That's what my Rebbe Yerush Shechter always says. Yiddish folklore is that teshu kein taduru. The way you live in your house, you got to do in your sukkah too. So you talk Lashon Hara in the sukkah. Okay, so you talk Lashon Hara in the home, in the sukkah, on the playground, in school, and then you'll talk in shul also. So when you talk Lashon Hara in shul, you're over on a whole bunch of Yisurim of Lashon Hara. You're also not showing reverence for the shul itself. A place of such kedusha to talk in such a way, such a disgusting manner, lashon hara, you know, evil speech. So that's a violation of es mikdashi tiro in the shul. The Chafetz Chaim in a footnote there goes on a tangent and he points out that regardless of what you think of es mikdashi tiro, if a person talks too much in shul, they're going to end up violating a different iser daraisa. Because we have a yesh ladan, a person could go back and forth about this. The Sefer Emek Bracha actually has a little bit about this. Emek Bracha was written by Ari Leib Pomeranchik, one of the Talmidim of the Briska Rav. So he wrote a Lamdus on Orach Chaim. So in that context, he has a discussion about whether talking during laning is actually an Isser Daraisa. It's a bittul of Kavod HaTorah, respect we're supposed to show for the Torah when it's out. We talk during laning. Could be it's an Isser Daraisa. Regardless of whether it's an Isser Daraisa or not, the Chafetz Chaim says to talk in the middle of laning in front of 10 Jewish men in a shul is a Chil Hashem Barabim. It's the greatest avon that we have in our Jewish religion. It's Chil Hashem in public. So to talk during laning, to talk during davening in a shul, it's terrible. It might be es mikdashi tiro, it might be a whole bunch of other things, but to talk in such a way that everyone's watching, it's a violation of the Chil Hashem, says the Chafetz Chaim. Again, this is, I personally think it's permissible. No, I'm joking. But the Chafetz Chaim writes this black and white. You could look it up. It's a terrible thing to talk during davening and certainly during laning as well. The Torah tells us in Kufna Nala that there's a mitzvah, literally a kiyum mitzvah of Ashrei Yoshvei Veisecha. We say the pasuk all the time. Ashrei Yoshvei Veisecha means fortunate is the person who sits in your house. Your house is the shul. So there's a mitzvah that a person has just by sitting in a shul, just by coming to shul and being in the shul. It's a mitzvah of Ashrei Yoshvei Veisecha. But the Shla comments that a person has that mitzvah only if they're treating the shul properly. If you start to have sicha batela, you talk about nothingness, you waste your time with idle speech in the middle of shul, so then not only are you having the es mikdashi tiro problem and the chilul Hashem problem, but you're also losing out on the mitzvah of sitting in a shul and having the soaking up the kedusha of Ashrei Yoshvei Veisecha. So a person has to be very careful about this all the time. Either way, the Shulchan Aruch paskins, like everything we said above, in terms of the shul itself, in Simen Kufnan Aleph, Sif Aleph, the Shulchan Aruch says that the shul has a certain level of kedusha, a higher level of kedusha, and therefore a person should not act with kalis rosh. What does kalis rosh mean? Lightheadedness, literally, right. Casual, frivolous, right? A person shouldn't act in such a way that they're not showing reverence, proper kavod, for the makom of the Beis HaKnesses. The Mishnah Berurah there brings a lot of what we spoke about in terms of es mikdashi tiro. With that background, we can come back to our question. So the Shulchan Aruch paskins appropriately that a person can't act with kalis rosh. They can't act in a frivolous, lightheaded manner in the shul. So what does that include? So the Shulchan Aruch gives us a whole bunch of things, including sleeping, talking, things that are not appropriate for a shul. Additionally, the Shulchan Aruch says, achila ushasiya, eating and drinking in the shul is problematic because that's mikdashi tiro. There's a mitzvah that we're supposed to act with a certain amount of reverence, a certain amount of kavod, respect, for the makom hamikdash me'at that we have in our shul. Now, in our tshuva, if you look back at the source sheet, so Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, it's really the Shoel, it's really the one who is inquiring over here who makes this point, but Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank records it, that the Shulchan Aruch does not exactly define eating for us, because there's really two types of eating. What are the two types of eating?
Kavua,
exactly. Meaning like a meal, right? Like a set meal, and? Arai, snacking. Ask a quick question.
In the middle of
davening.
Right. And you're not allowed to
eat. What does the shul do here? They throw candy at bar mitzvah?
Sometimes, yes.
So then I would like to take a lot of time to think about how to answer the question. I don't have an answer on the spot, but I just one thing I'll say is that it could really hurt. If you choose the wrong candy, if they don't do the sun kiss,
yeah, right.
Sun kiss is like a good cushion at least, but. First, we have to talk about if you're allowed to throw it. Then we can talk about whether you're allowed to eat in the shul. There's a lot to talk about there. Good. Right. Right, but that's good. So we'll get back to something similar to that. Very good. Very good. Exactly. Okay. So let's continue here. So there are two types of eating. Cesar Cipas Frank. Again, really, it's the person who was the shoel, the one who was asking the question over here. There's two types of eating. There's a type of eating which is a set meal, and there's a type of eating which is a temporary snack, just a short, a quick bite of something to eat. And there are two types of eating. Is only a set meal problematic in a shul, or can a person not even snack? Again, that would come back to your point. Eating the candy is not really a meal. I mean, it depends on the kid, I guess. But it's not supposed to be a meal. One of my sons, yesterday, I think he only had dessert. But normally, we're not supposed to do that. We're supposed to have a whole meal, but you don't want to mess with this kid, trust me. So is that considered eating, or it's only considered eating if you sit down to a real meal? So the shoel in our tshuva over here, if you look in the third paragraph, the second paragraph, B'inyan Achilas Arai, that one. So he suggests that we should compare it to a different area of halacha, the halachos of tefillin. In the halachos of tefillin, which it comes from a gemara in Brachos on Chav Gimel Amud Beis, Paskin in Shulchan Aruch, in Simen Mem. So the Shulchan Aruch talks about the difference, the distinction between Achilas Keva and Achilas Arai. And the eating in tefillin, again, this is not halacha lemaisa, because nowadays we treat tefillin differently than they did in the earlier times. It's complicated how we get there, but it's not for now. But strictly speaking, Me'ikar Din, strictly speaking, the Gemara assumes there's a distinction between eating a snack and eating a meal when you're wearing tefillin. Eating a meal would be inappropriate. Eating a snack may be a little bit more acceptable. In that context, the halacha assumes that the reason for the problem of eating in tefillin is an issue of kalis rosh, meaning if a person eats in their tefillin a whole meal, they're going to be light-headed, they're going to be casual, they're going to be out to lunch, literally. And what happens when you're out to lunch is you forget about what you're involved in. So they're going to forget they're wearing their tefillin. And the whole point of wearing tefillin is to remember the whole time. That's why the halacha says you have to touch your tefillin every once in a while to be mishamish in the tefillin. The Gemara learns that from a kal v'chomer from the tzitz. The Kohen's tzitz, he had to be careful to know it was on his head. So we have to know that the tefillin are on our head, are on our arms. And if we're in the middle of a big fressing on a big suda, so we're going to be, like I said, out to lunch. We're going to forget where we're holding. We're going to forget we're wearing tefillin. So it's all based on the same idea of kalas rosh. So maybe we should draw a comparison between those two sugyas, suggest the one asking the question here in the tshuva of Tzvi Pesach Frank. Just so we know, Agav, just by the way, what is the shir? How do you define achilas arai? How do you define when something is a snack versus when something is a full meal? Kibetza, very good. When do we say that? You're right, but when do we say that? Pesach is an interesting point. What's another holiday? Sukkos, very good. So on Sukkos, the Mishnah Berurah tells us in Siman Mem, here in Hilchos Tefillin, on Sukkos, we have a rule that you're only chayiv to eat in the sukkah when it's a achila kibetza, which makes it into an achilas keva, as opposed to an achilas arai, which is exactly the point you made. And he tries to draw the comparison from sukkah to Hilchos Tefillin as well. There was a posting of Avram Weinfeld. Avram Weinfeld was a survivor, like a real survivor. He went through a lot. He writes about it, his experience in the concentration camps and being driven out of the concentration camps into literally, it's hard to even talk about, whatever. He suffered a lot in the Holocaust. He came to America, and he was a chassidisher. He was a posik also. He's like a contemporary of Moshe Feinstein. He argues on a few things. Maybe you heard of his son, Rabbi Cheskel Weinfeld. He's a prominent rav in Eretz Yisrael currently. So he has a tshuva sefer called Lev Avram. So in Lev Avram, he quotes this Mishnah Berurah and says it makes no sense to him. It's not comparable. For example, a person can drink a full cup of beer or a full can of beer or whatever outside of a sukkah on Sukkos. Why? Because it's just a drink. It's just a mashke. So it doesn't matter if you're in the sukkah or not. Maybe some people have a chumrah to drink it inside of the sukkah, but you don't have to, technically speaking, drink it inside of the sukkah. Could a person drink a whole can of beer while they're wearing tefillin? Absolutely not. The whole reason not to eat is because you don't want to forget that you're wearing tefillin. You can't get the drunk in your tefillin. That's a terrible idea. So they're not comparable, the two cases. So how could you learn one kibetza from sukkah to Hilchos Tefillin? So he suggests other things. He's not sure what the shir could be. He suggests maybe it's three or four beitzos, which is more similar to the halachos of Pas Bava Kisnin. It's something to look into at a different time, how to exactly define. But, you know, we'll make it having a pack of gushers versus having a meal. Clearly, we're talking about snack versus achilas keva, set meal. Okay, so the shoel here had suggested, or Tzvi Pesach Frank quotes it, had suggested that we compare a tefillin and eating in a shul to each other, and therefore we should say that there should be a distinction between a snack and an actual meal. But if you look in the one, two, three, third paragraph, it starts Hinei Zeh. The Rav Tzvi HaZafran here goes on to quote how the Shaul himself raised an interesting suffix, an interesting doubt in terms of the comparison. It could be that our comparison until now has in fact been pretty faulty. Because in truth, if you read over here, the eating in the shul and the eating in tefillin are actually two very different sugyas based on two very different concerns. The tefillin issue is an issue of, what did we say before? It's an issue of kalas rosh. Why? Because what's going to happen if you lose track of where you're holding with your tefillin? You're going to forget you're wearing tefillin. You're going to have hesach hadas. You're going to have a lapse in your cognizance of the fact that you're wearing tefillin. In a shul, what's the issue? What do we start with until now? What are we trying to accomplish and not and avoid in the shul? Respect, awe, kavod, reverence for the shul. So if I show reverence to the shul, show kavod to the shul, good. And if I do other things, like let's just say for now, sleep, or if I have a schmooze in the middle of shul, that's not showing reverence for the shul. So it's an issue of kavod, not an issue of forgetting what you're wearing on your head, not an issue the same as the tefillin. So are they really the same issue, or are they separate sugyas entirely? So Rav Tzvi HaZafran here in the next paragraph, ulam, really, I guess technically two paragraphs later, ulam. So here, Rav Tzvi HaZafran suggests that exactly what we're talking about is subject to a machlokes in Girsaos, in the Gemara in Megillah. We'll read together just a little bit. Ulam davar ze im tam shel isra achilu shesiyah beis haknesses hu mishum kalas rosh. This question of what is the driving force behind the issue of eating in a shul, is it really because of kalas rosh, because it's going to cause you to be very casual and lightheaded in the course of your eating? That question, is it dependent on that reasoning? L'chora tali b'shtei nuschaos ha-gemara b'megillah chav chesa med aleph. L'chora, it depends, it's hinging upon two possible ways of having the text in the Gemara in Maseches Megillah. The Gemara says, Tanur Rabbanan, Abraisa, Bate Kinesios, Shuls, Ein Noagin Bohen Kalas Rosh. Okay? We can't have Kalas Rosh. We can't act with frivolousness in the Shul. We can't act casually. Continues the Gemara, Ein Ochlin Bohen, Ve'ein Shosin Bohen. So if you read the Gemara that way, the Gemara says, you can't act with Kalas Rosh, colon, you can't eat, you can't drink in a Shul. The other possibility, Rashi says, ein ochlin bahen vilogar sinan vit ein ochlin bahen. The other possibility is that there's a vav before the vit ein ochlin bahen, which means it would read as follows. In a shul, you can't have kalas rosh, you can't act frivolously, you can't act casually, vit ein ochlin bahen, and additionally, you also cannot eat in them. So what's the difference between the first way we said it and the second way we said it? The first way we said it, the Gemara is saying, you can't have kalas rosh, therefore, here's an example of what's considered kalas rosh, you can't eat or drink in a shul. The second possibility is, no, that the Gemara is saying, you can't have kalas rosh in a shul, and you can't eat or drink in a shul, a separate halacha entirely. So says Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, this very question, what's the reason for the isser of eating in the shul? Is it because we need to show kavod to the shul and eating is a lack of kavod? Or is it because you can't have kalas rosh in a shul, just like by tefillin? That seems to be subject to two ways to read the Gemara, depending on the text that you have inside. Did everyone follow that? That's an interesting distinction in the text. And based on that, it may be that the Shaul is right or incorrect in terms of what the reasoning is and whether we can compare the Beis HaKnesses, the Shul, eating in the Shul, to the case of eating while wearing tefillin. Either way, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank argues. If you look in, again, the last paragraph on page number one, and it'll flip over onto page number two as well, the Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank argues that even if they're both Misham Kalas Rosh, even if you, at the end of the day, you say that the reason you can't eat in tefillin is because it causes lightheadedness to eat in your tefillin, and you're going to forget you're wearing tefillin. And the reason you can't eat in shul is also because of kalas rosh, because of lightheadedness, because of the casual nature of doing that activity in the shul. Even if you say both are because of kalas rosh, we still cannot compare the two of them. They're still very different. Tefillin and shul are extremely different. Why are they different? And here we get to lumdas. Here we get to a little bit of a fundamental distinction that's going to end up being very yesodistic, very fundamental, as we said, and also a guiding principle in this halacha and really in all of our activities in a shul. If you look in the same paragraph but start on page two, the bold on the top of page number two, V'yesh lahav chin kan. We have to distinguish over here. Listen closely to this. This is interesting. V'yesh lahav chin kan bein kalas rosh bepa'ula shi'yesh ba'kalas rosh mitzad atzma. You have to distinguish between the type of kalas rosh, lightheadedness, casual nature, frivolousness, which is objectively kalas rosh. It's objectively an inappropriate manner of behavior. Uben kalas rosh bepeula shemitzad atzma einena begeder kalas rosh. There's a type of kalas rosh which inherently it's not an inappropriate behavior. It's not too casual and too frivolous. And inherently, objectively, ella kishi nasasa bemakom kadosh kama beis haknesses yesh bamishem kalas rosh. But contextually, it's a theory of relativity. Contextually, relative to being in a beis hamedrash, a beis haknesses, a beis hamikdash, then that act becomes frivolous, becomes inappropriate, becomes too casual. What are we talking about? So let's say like this. Schmoozing, and I don't know, having a big schmooze with a lot of jokes. So that's objectively kalas rosh. It's objectively very casual. So that could take place in a house, and it shouldn't take place in a makom kadosh, in a beis mikdash, in a shul. Having a big casual conversation, correct? That's easy to understand? Fine. What about eating? Is eating a casual act? Eating is a normal act. We eat every day. We're supposed to. It could be very formal. Eating could be very formal. It's not necessarily, it's definitely not disrespectful. You're supposed to eat every day. It's normal to eat every day. So the act of eating is not inherently, objectively kalas rosh. When does it become kalas rosh? When you do it in the wrong place. A shul is not for eating. A shul is for davening. A shul is for learning. A shul is for divrei kedusha, divrei Torah. And therefore, eating in a shul, it might become kalas rosh, but it's not objectively, inherently kalas rosh. Those are two very different types of situations. So, says Ritzi Pesach Frank, when it comes to tefillin, the issue of tefillin is hesach hadas, as we said the whole time, a lapse in cognizance of the fact you're wearing tefillin. So what ruins your cognizance, your consciousness about the fact that you're wearing tefillin? An act of eating can ruin it even if it's not objectively kalas rosh. Because eating while you're wearing tefillin takes your mind off of your tefillin. So therefore, eating is a problem by tefillin. If it's an achilas arai, it's just a snack. It's just a snack. So I'll keep track. I'm going to have a pack of gushers and I'll remember that I'm wearing my... What do you guys eat for snacks? Gushers is not a good example. You look like an apple with peanut butter type of crew. Okay, you eat a little bit of an apple with a little bit of an apple. You're saying you're not seminary girls. So what do you eat? What a snack? What's a good snack? No snacking. No snacking.
Baby carrots.
Baby carrots. Interesting. So nobody hang out with this guy. I have a coffee, a little bit of a snack, right? Okay, a little crackers. How's crackers? Cookies. A little bit of a snack. So is that going to take your mind off of tefillin? It's not going to take your mind off of tefillin. You're going to remember you're wearing tefillin. But if you sit down to a whole three-course meal in the middle of the day while you're wearing tefillin, you're going to forget you're wearing tefillin. So there, in the halacha of tefillin, we distinguish between the two types of achila, a snack versus a meal. However, when it comes to eating in a shul, what's the reason you can't eat in a shul? It's also because of kalas rosh. But how do you define the kalas rosh? It's not that this is inherently a problem. It's that eating in a shul is problematic because of the context. Well, who distinguishes between eating a snack and eating a meal? The eating itself is not the issue. It's the fact that you're doing it in a shul, regardless of how much you shove down your throat, whether it's a pack of gushers, whether it's cookies, whether it's baby carrots, whether it's a coffee, whatever it is, it's not the right place. It's not the right time. So at that level of distinguishing between kalas rosh and not kalas rosh, when we're talking about relative kalas rosh, there's no real room to distinguish between achilas arai and achilas keva, and therefore maybe in a shul, it should be across the board problematic to eat in that place at that time. That's what Rabbi Pesach Frank here suggests in the top of page number 2 and also the second paragraph that you have here on page number 2 as well. He continues to make that point as well. Yeah, based on this fundamental distinction between objective kalas rosh and subjective kalas rosh, so Rabbi Pesach Frank continues in the next paragraph, Uvederach Zos, he continues to explain an interesting leniency, an interesting kula, which we find in the poskim. The Mechaber, the Shulchan Aruch, in Simen Kufnan Aleph Sif Dalet, says that whenever you have a tzorech, a necessity, to eat or drink or sleep in the shul, so then it sometimes becomes permissible to do so. One example, which probably doesn't have so much relevance, if you're a guard who's guarding the shul, we do have security, I don't know if you have here in the shul, but a lot of shuls have security teams, they're usually outside of the shul. But if for some reason you can imagine a case, maybe it was a one-room shul, and the guy was standing inside because it was the winter, and it was cold outside, so he was guarding the shul. But he needs to, overnight, he needs to fall asleep a little bit. Not such a good guard, I guess. But, okay, maybe he has another friend who's helping him out. I don't know. So he has two people, and one of them needs to take a nap. So So what do you do? What do you do in that case? So it's a tzorech. He absolutely needs to fall asleep. So then there's sometimes leniency. There's sometimes rule to be makel for such a person. Additionally, the Shulchan Aruch mentions it, if there's a tzorech mitzvah, or really the way we understand it is a sudas mitzvah, meaning if you're making a meal, which is a sudas mitzvah, it's a meal contextualized by a mitzvah. It's a meal celebrating and surrounding a mitzvah. That will be a permissible thing to do in the shul. What's an example of a sudas mitzvah? So we'll not get to our first example yet, but a bar mitzvah. A siyum. Tonight I have a siyum hashas. Someone from our kolal, one of the donors to our kolal actually, everyone's invited to come. I don't know if you're on the WhatsApp group. If you're not on the WhatsApp group, on top of the sheet right now, you just take out your camera, scan it, or visit the website. That's easy. You get right into the WhatsApp group. And we barely send messages. It's not overwhelming. It's not overwhelming.
No, informative messages.
Informative messages, yeah. Yeah.
Bris like that?
Bris. Suda's mitzvah, yeah. Yeah. Just to be clear, because it was a little out of context, we don't do brises in the WhatsApp group. He meant that he was getting back to the sugya. We have announcements in the WhatsApp group. Shev brachos, sudas mitzvah that you have in the shul. So, anyways, we have a siyum hashas tonight. If you want to join, it's a beautiful thing. So, it's a sudas mitzvah. It's something which is surrounding a mitzvah. So that can take place in the shul. However, that is not a blanket heter. That's not a blanket leniency that goes across the board. There are exceptions to that rule. The Magen Avraham in his commentary, this is explained by the Prima Gadim and then subsequently by the Mishnah Brura, the Magen Avraham in his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch over there says that it's limited to a very specific type of Suda's mitzvah. The Suda of Ibur Hashanah, when they would be Ma'abar the Shana, they would add a month to the year, a second Adar, so they would make a Suda around the context of building that month into the year. And in that Suda, they would only have a little bit of grain, just like a little bit of bread. They didn't have much to eat at that Suda. That's the type of Suda, says the Magen Avraham, which is allowed in a shul. Once you're involving wine and extravagances and all types of food that really gets you heavy and really gets you potentially even drunk, and there's a concern about the shichrus, intoxication, then we're going to have an issue with eating in a shul. So we'll get to the questions in a second. There's a few of them. What the Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank here in Hartzvi explains is that you only understand this leniency once you understand the basis we just developed. If there's an objective isser of eating in a shul because it's kalas rosh objectively, who cares if it's a sudas mitzvah? Eating in a shul is inappropriate. But if the whole idea is, no, eating in a shul is inappropriate because it's in a shul, and a shul is for what? It's for divrei mitzvah, for divrei kedusha. Okay, so it's a theory again of relativity, right? It's relative to the shul, this is inappropriate. Fine, but what if it's a mitzvah meal? What if it's for a siyum hashas? What if it's for a shev brachos? What if it's for a bar mitzvah, etc.? It's a sudas mitzvah. There's divrei Torah. Oh, contextualized, now it's not such an inappropriate thing to do in a shul. So you can hear the poskim saying that a sudas mitzvah would be allowed in a shul, because it really changes based on the context, because again, it's all relative, it's all subjective. Now, the Magen Avraham did say that only applies to a meal that's not going to have wine and a lot of action in that way. So because of that, some of the poskim are more machmir, Tzvi Pesach Frank himself. Additionally, Rav Eliashiv has a tshuva in the first chelik of his kovitz tshuvos, where he says, because of this, you can't make a wedding in a shul. Now, just to be clear, there's two separate issues with making a wedding in a shul. The chuppah in the shul and having the meal in the shul. You have some shuls, you guys ever have weddings in this shul?
Yes.
So you have some shuls where you do a chuppah in the shul, and then you can do a meal down here. I mean, this is a pretty big room, or outside, or whatever.
The social hall is the same.
Right, social hall. Right. So you have that. There is actually a halachic dispute about whether you're allowed to have a chuppah in a shul. That is a discussion. But let's say you're having the chuppah in the shul, that's fine. Right, okay. That's a different discussion. So what about having the meal in the shul? So that, Rav Eliashiv says, is inappropriate. Because that meal in the shul is definitely going to have a lot of excitement and a lot of, and probably wine and a lot of food, and therefore will fall into the Magen Avraham's example of what you're not allowed to do in a shul. So that, again, not everyone agrees. If you look in the Shalosh Tshuvas Yechav Adas Chelek Gimel, the third volume of Rav Avadya Yosef's Tshuvas Yechav Adas, so he paskins Lakula on this, he's Makel on this, he's lenient, that even a Sudas Mitzvah, which involves a lot of festivities, is also permissible. He says that some of the Rishonim said what the Magen Avraham said, but most of the Rishonim didn't agree and thought any Sudas Mitzvah is okay because it contextualizes what's going on, and therefore it's completely permissible. Matt, and then everyone else. Although I have a feeling whatever Matt's going to say is going to shut everyone else down.
Let's talk. Let's say you're like, we talk about not davening, not eating in a place like a shul.
Right.
Like public. So like when you go to, let's say, a wedding, and there are already people eating and drinking all over, and then guys go off to the side and like try to make a meeting inside a place where there's already people eating, is that also a question? Or is that...
I mean, it's good. That is a good question. I mean, there's multiple things to deal with. First, you're not making it into a shul, so that's not the issue. It's a question of davening in a place that's appropriate or inappropriate. So if there's, there's multiple issues to deal with. If it's too loud to focus or hear the davening, so that is an issue in terms of kavana. The minig is certainly to make the minyan for multiple reasons. First of all, even people who are planning to daven the minyan later, a wedding, this is an issue we should fix societally, but weddings are very, very long. They shouldn't be so long, but they're very, very long. So if a person can be stuck at a wedding for so, there's a lot of things we should fix about weddings. There's a person can be stuck at a wedding for so long, so Chas Shalom is going to miss Marv daven by himself. That's not beseder. So even Rabbanim, even people who are planning to daven, they daven at the wedding all the time. There is a halacha about how to daven when it's a noisy room. Usually we daven in such a way, the Gemara in Brachos tells us, learning from Chana, that we daven in such a way that kola lo yishama, that her voice was not heard. You have to whisper in such a way that you can hear, your ears are able to hear your words, but no one around you should be able to hear your words. It's hard to hit the nail on the head, but that's what we're supposed to do. The halacha says that when you're in a crowded room, and you can't hear yourself when you whisper, you're supposed to daven much louder so you can hear yourself. That's one of the few times you're supposed to daven out loud. The other time is there's a heter, the Shulchan Aruch says, on Yom Noraim, to daven a little bit louder, or at home, to be mechanech children. But generally speaking, we're supposed to daven in a more quiet manner. There's a very interesting Sifsei Chachamim on the Torah, which says that when you find by Moshe Rabbeinu, he would daven after each of the makos to make sure that the makos would disappear. So by the mak of Tzvardeya, he screams out his tefillah. So what are you? You're not allowed to scream out your tefillah. It's a tefillah supposed to be quiet. So the commentary, some of the commentaries say that no, he screamed because all the frogs were there. You know what they were doing? They were croaking, they were ribbiting, they were making all the noise. So he couldn't hear himself daven, so he had to daven in a louder way in order to hear himself. Okay, so at a chasana, there's a way to daven, but you're making a shul out of it. You're not taking the shul and putting it into the wedding hall. Yeah. In the case of Shalosh Shudas, which is really how we started, with Shalosh Shudas. So is that considered a Sudas Mitzvah? So Ratzi Pesach Frank makes the argument, the second to last paragraph over here, that it obviously is a Sudas Mitzvah. Not everyone agrees, but he assumes it's obvious that Shabbos meal is a Sudas Mitzvah. It's a mitzvah to eat on Shabbos, and therefore it's a Sudas Mitzvah to have a Shabbos meal, Shalosh Shudas being one of them. That's an important point to focus on for a second. Shalosh Shudas is a mitzvah. Shalosh Shudas is a mitzvah for men and for women. So we should be careful to eat Shalosh Shudas. It's a little easier in the summer months now. In the winter months, I could speak for myself, it's very difficult. I'm very, very full from lunch. I happen to not be able to eat so much in general, but definitely on a short day, it's hard to eat Shalosh Shudas, but it's a mitzvah. We're supposed to eat Shalosh Shudas. The less hungry you are to eat Shalosh Shudas, the bigger mitzvah it is to eat the Shalosh Shudas. So you should see it as a schus if you're not hungry by the time Shalosh Shudas comes around. But okay, there's a Sudas mitzvah involved in Shalosh Shudas. That being said, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank says, there is a chashash shichrus. I mean, it might not be that you ever go to the shul shalosh shudas. I don't know if you can get drunk on egg salad and old tuna, crusty tuna. But although I guess the older the tuna is, the more likely you could get drunk from it. But fine aged tuna. There's a chashash shichrus in the sense that it's a festive meal. There's a lot of food going on, and therefore it may be problematic in the shul. Rav Adi Yosef quotes the Netziv, who says that a sudas shlishis, a shalosh shudas, is permissible in a shul because it's certainly a sudas mitzvah. Definitely, if people say divrei Torah there, Rav Moshe Feinstein in Chelek Aleph Virgas Moshe Simon Mem Hey is also lenient on this. He thinks that eating a sudas shalosh shudas in a shul is permissible. He says the Chassidim are makel on yahrzeit meals, but we don't agree with that. We think a yahrzeit meal is a dvar shus, and therefore is not permissible. There's an interesting discussion in that same a different tshuva in Rav Adi Yosef Sichav Das. In an earlier chiluk, in chiluk beis, he has a tshuva about smoking in a shul. Is it permissible to smoke in a shul? We're not assuming smoking is mutter. But if a person already is smoking, are they allowed to do so in a shul? So he gives three reasons why that should not be permissible in a shul. First of all, maybe it's similar to achila and shesia. Maybe smoking is considered halachically eating or drinking, taking in something into your body. That is a fascinating thing. When else would that matter? Whatever, but fast days, exactly. Fast days in general. So the post can have fascinating discussions about this. Is that considered drinking and eating on a fast day to do so? Okay, it's stam kalas rosh to smoke in a shul. It's not the right place or time for it. And lastly, it's a chil Hashem to smoke in a shul. Why is it a chil Hashem to smoke in a shul? Rav Adi Yosef is quoting those who assume that Goyim don't let you smoke in their churches. I don't know if that's true. Maybe there are smoking churches and non-smoking churches. I don't know. But if it's true that at the services of a non-Jew, you're not allowed to smoke, so then how could we be any more lenient than the non-Jews, the Ovdei Avodah Zarah? So therefore, it's an inappropriate thing to do. Either way, we had this concept of Sudas Mitzvah, and some are Mekel, or Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank himself, is a little bit machmir about Shalosh Shudas, about eating in the shul. But we do see there's some reason for a license to eat a Sudas Mitzvah in a shul. We all agree with that. The reasoning being what Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank explained to us, which is that the whole idea of not eating the shul is really a contextual one. It's really relative to the Kedushas HaBeis HaKnesses. If you can do a Suda that's also Kaddish, that's also holy, that's a Sudas Mitzvah, that's a Dvar Mitzvah, then perhaps it becomes permissible in a shul. Now, what does this have to do with Shavuos? Staying up all night, Shavuos night, is not a Sudas Mitzvah. the women don't know what goes on, but trust me, it's not a Suez mitzvah. Doesn't seem that way, and you're there all night. So is there any license to eat in the shul overnight, Shavuos? So the Shulchan Aruch Paskins here in Siman Kufnan Aleph, the Shulchan Aruch Paskins like the Rambam, that Talmidei Chachamim, we'll define that term soon, but Talmidei Chachamim, scholars will say for now, learners are able to eat and drink in a Beis HaKnesses, in a Beis Medrash, as long as they need to do so. What does it mean they need to do so? So the Magen Avraham comments that the tzorech, the necessity to do so, is because it's bittul Torah for them to get up and go out of the shul every time they need to eat. You sit in a Beis Medrash and learn, let's say he's a real learner. He's there 18 hours a day. So every time he needs to have a snack or a drink or a meal, he has to step out and sit there for 15 minutes. Otherwise, he'd use those 15 minutes to learn. So if he's going to waste his time, so we'd rather him learn through that time. There are details here in terms of the halachos, but we'll start with that Shulchan Aruch. So what is the definition of a Talmid Chacham? Only someone who's a big, knowledgeable person is a Talmid Chacham can eat in a shul and everyone else can't do so? So, or is it the opposite? Is any Talmud, anyone who comes to a shir, is already considered able to take advantage of this heter? So the Mishnah Brura assumes that only someone who learns full-time, only someone who learns full-time is able to take advantage of this leniency and eat or drink in the shul in order to save their time. But some of the poskim, the later poskim, point out that if you look at what the Magen Avraham said, he said the reasoning was what? Bittul Torah. So whether it's someone who learns all day, or whether it's you and me who come once in a while to hear a shir, to learn together for a few minutes, it's still bittul Torah. We ate our breakfast during the shir. We're not going to get up in the middle of shir and stop eating and come back and stop the shir and start the shir. We have to go through the learning, and we don't want to waste so much time. So we're able to eat during the shir, even if it's in the shul. And that's the leniency of Talmidei Chachamim. It's not literally limited to Talmidei Chachamim, but rather it applies to anyone who's trying to take advantage of their time and learn in the shul, so they shouldn't have to leave every time they need to take a snack, every time they need to eat, in order to keep them going in their learning. It goes without saying that when a person is learning all night on Shavuos, so there are times over the course of the night where they need to take a drink of coffee, take something to eat in order to keep them going. So technically speaking, based on what we just learned together, there's not a Suez mitzvah, but at least you're considered a Talmid Chacham in the sense that it's a waste of time. If every time I have to have a coffee, you have to have a coffee every 10 minutes overnight Shavuos. Every time I'm going to have to sit outside for 10 minutes to drink it because it's hot, that's not right, so you should drink it in the shul. But then you have to start to think, when they bring out the sushi meal, and when they bring out the dairy buffet, and when they bring out the second sushi, so every time they bring out the food and you have to eat again even though you're not hungry, because you're really there to eat all night, not to learn all night. So every time they bring out a meal, you have to eat in the shul? Or maybe no, in those cases when you're there and you're not actually, you know, taking advantage of the learning at that moment, so eat the food outside of the shul. Don't be mechalel the kedusha of the Beis HaKnesses. So it's worth cheshbon each time. So yeah, the coffee and the water, there seems to be license. It's certainly the minhag, certainly the tradition is to be mekel on this, to be lenient on this, to eat and drink a little bit in the shul to keep yourself going over the course of the night. But a person should be cognizant of the fact that you're still in the Beis HaKnesses, you're still in the Beis HaMedrash, you're still in a holy place, and therefore as the eating gets more extravagant, so a person wants the cheshbon how much they should be doing that in the shul or not over the course of the night. Everyone should enjoy a wonderful Shavuos, the Chatzi Lachem and the Chatzi Lashem. The learning should be geshmak, the eating should be geshmak, and if they come together at certain points, that's also geshmak. Everyone have a wonderful day. Yeah. I mean, obviously,